Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. Thank you, Leo, for the shakuhachi. I actually thought the wind blowing was you on the shakuhachi. So I was just waiting for I was waiting for you to stop because that's my cue. Well, thank you for being here this morning, everybody. Can I move this a little bit?
Sure.
Is that going to... So I can, you know, pass. Yeah, that's better. Yeah, that's better. I'll wait. There's a cushion here and a cushion there. So I've had the expression silent illumination on my mind lately. I talked a little about it during a half-day retreat in May, I think. And so I just want to say a little more about it today. So I'm going to, on your program, there's kind of a general description of it. I pulled this from different sources, so I'm just going to read that first. A beautiful expression for Zazen, that's Zen meditation, is silent illumination. It is the expression of a peaceful mind. But a peaceful mind does not mean there is no mental activity. There are many practices which can give you a quiet, still, peaceful mind, but at the cost of cutting off awareness. Equally, we can have a very illuminated mind in the sense of having many thoughts and ideas, but it's not calm. Silent illumination means bringing both together in balance. So, we get that, don't we? Those of us who've been practicing for a while, we get the peaceful mind even though there's mental activity, right? Because the practice is not about trying to stop our thoughts. It's not about shutting down. So I won't be talking about silent illumination in regards to mental activity. I'm more interested in how silent illumination supports us during the difficult times when our strong emotions come up. So the expression was actually coined in the 12th century by Master Chin Chui. He wrote a poem called Song of Silent Illumination. It's a long poem, so I just pulled this verse that really resonated with me the most. The verse is, "In silence, words are forgotten. In utter clarity, things appear." So, in silence, words are forgotten. In utter clarity, things appear. So, words are forgotten. No words, no language, no ideas, no thoughts. So this is the silent aspect. Obviously, utter clarity refers to illumination, the illumination aspect. But so often, whenever a strong emotion arises, what arises with it is a general sense of confusion and anxiety. So, what gives? That was my question. Because if silent illumination can't withstand our strong emotions, then what good is it? I mean, really, what good is it? So I've been giving that question a lot of thought lately, partly because of something I came across years ago and have come across several times since in my reading that says, until you've practiced through difficulty, you're not really a Zen student. So on one level, practicing through difficulty simply means keeping a regular sitting practice through a crisis. That's hard enough. But it also means enduring the strong emotions that come up in meditation without drowning in them. So that's a little harder. The verse said, in silence, words are forgotten, and utter clarity, things appear. So what about this utter clarity when we're practicing in difficulty? Well, within the direct experience of a sensation, there is utter clarity. This has been my experience. It's been my experience that the sensation clarifies itself completely when we stay with it, when we stay present and open, which is only done through kind awareness. Because kindness and openness are two aspects of the same state. One can't exist without the other. So it's not the sensation of an emotion that creates the confusion. It's our thoughts that arise with the emotion, pulling our awareness away from actually feeling the sensation and into thinking about the emotion. And thinking about an emotion, in my experience, always causes confusion. Trying to figure it out. We try to figure it out. It just gets us more and more entangled in mental activity and further away from the clarity of direct experience. We can't figure out an emotion. We can reframe it, which is a therapeutic approach, and that can be helpful. Or we can just appease ourselves by settling on a story about it. But we can't really figure it out. It's like trying to figure out the taste of an orange or a lemon. In silence, words are forgotten. We don't try to figure it out. In utter clarity, things appear. So in the sensation itself, in the feeling it, there is utter clarity. So the question is, can we stay with these sensations? Can we just allow the presence of a strong sensation, of a strong emotion? So what the verse tells us is that the way we allow the presence of a strong emotion is by coming back to the silence over and over, but not at the expense of the illumination, not by shutting down. If we focus too narrowly in a rigid way on the breath or visualizing a mandala or repeating a mantra, we may feel really calm, but we're not open. So for the illumination aspect of silent illumination, we have to also be open. So the description that works best for me is this. Silent illumination is a quiet, unintrusive awareness that allows us to be with our strong emotions. both surface-level emotions, which is usually just emotional reactivity, surface-level emotions, but also the deep pent-up emotions, which is often the underlying source of our reactivity, of our emotional reactivity. Because utter clarity means that we see beyond our emotional reactivity to its source. And this is called seeing through. We talk about seeing through quite a bit in Zen. So when we're able to remain open as the silence penetrates, deeper and deeper regions of our psyche are illuminated. Deep emotions arise. They clarify themselves through expression and then dissolve. So, this has been my experience. I can only talk from my experience. Tim calls it, our head teacher, Tim Burkett, calls it going into the cave of our psyche with our flashlight of bare awareness. So, in meditation, we're not unmoving and indifferent. Silent illumination is not about becoming apathetic. We may be stone still on the outside, but we don't sit like a stone. We sit like a mountain. Think about all the activity on a mountain. There's a lot going on. Think about the predators and the prey, the constant pursuing and avoiding. Two of the three poisons, for those of you who know that teaching. There's a lot of emotional reactivity involved in pursuing and avoiding, right? So on the mountain, the soil, the underbrush, the trees, they buzz with beings. Beings of all kinds. Katagiri Roshi referred to our emotions and our thoughts and all the movements that go on inside us. He referred to those as beings. So on a mountain, the birds circle overhead, the wind blows, the leaves tremble. We all know how that feels, right? But when the trembling starts, we just keep coming back to the silence. Silence and illumination. They stay together. And underneath all the activity, the mountain just sits. Just sits. Right in the midst of all the chaos, the mountain is completely still and peaceful. And completely aware of everything. Because it's the mountain. It's not separate from the foxes and the rabbits and the goats and the leaves trembling in the wind. The mountain is not separate from all that. So the question is, how do we get there? How do we open up to this mountain, to this state of peacefulness right in the middle of our strongest emotions? So there's a story that I seem to return to over and over, and I wondered if it would tell me something about the process of silent illumination. I first came across this story over 20 years ago in Women Who Runs with the Wolves. A lot of you have heard of that book, I'm sure. By the story collector and mythologist Dr. Clarissa Estes. But this is not her version of the story. So if you read her book, it won't be the same. So at the heart of this story, this Japanese folktale, very old Japanese folktale, is the Japanese moon bear, which is considered a sacred being in Japan. He's brown, she is brown, with a large patch of white fur right across the chest, and it's shaped like a crescent moon. And according to the mythology, the white mark was given to him by Kuan Yin, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. So this story that I'm about to read and talk about is a mythological depiction of silent illumination. So there are no actual characters in this story, okay? Every element that's introduced depicts an unfolding aspect of our psyche during meditation. And in this story, five layers of consciousness are penetrated. So this is advanced practice. But of course, any division in consciousness is just arbitrary. You may see it completely differently. It was helpful for me in my creating the story, tweaking the story. So first I'm just going to read it. It's kind of long. I'm just going to read it through, and then I'll go back and talk about it. So once in Japan during wartime, there was a woman who lived in the foothills of a beautiful mountain. For many years, her husband has been away, fighting the war. Finally, she gets the news that he's coming home. But when he arrives, he's not the husband that she knew. He is angry. So angry he refuses to talk to anyone or let anyone get close to him. He stays outside in the forest surrounding their small hut. For weeks, the wife tries to persuade him to come inside and talk to her. Finally, she goes into the village to seek help from an old healer. "I can help your husband," the old woman says. "But to make the herbal remedy, I'll need a white hair from the moon bear who lives on the summit." So the woman gathers up some provisions, and at dawn of the following day, she starts up the mountain. The trail is steep, narrow, and overgrown. She cuts her way through the underbrush, vines, and low-hanging branches using a short, curved blade. It's called a kama, or a kama. I think I'm pronouncing that right. It's a farming implement used to chop crops. It's a curved blade. So she's chopping her way through up the mountain. But the more she cuts away, the more overgrown the trail becomes. And at times it disappears altogether. As the sun sets on the first day, she has to cross a shallow but powerful river. It's a rush of white water slamming against boulders, knocking her off balance and blinding her with spray. When night comes, there's just a sliver of a moon, and dark, shadowy birds circle overhead. "Spirits of the dead," the woman whispers to herself. "Spirits of the dead." Suddenly, she's scooped up and carried off by one of the spirits. When she finally wrenches herself free and tumbles back to the ground, she is disoriented and lost, trembling with fright, and the trail is nowhere in sight. She takes shelter in a cave, but it's a long and sleepless night because there are cave dwellers here. Demons, spirits, and phantoms taunt her throughout the night. But the next morning, in the light of day, she discovers that the trail goes right past the entrance of the cave. Having lost her kama, the blade she was using, she now moves slowly and deliberately along the overgrown trail. Soon, and to her amazement, the trail begins to open up as she approaches. The overhangs lift, and the vines and the underbrush parts as she approaches. Finally, she reaches the summit and comes face to face with the moon bear. He charges toward her, stopping just a few feet away. He slams his front paws onto the ground and rises to his full height and lets out an angry roar. That's when she notices a large splinter in his front paw. She knows that she will have to tend to this wound if he is ever to grant her a white hair from the crescent moon on his chest. So day after day she watches the moon bear amble about, roaring and waving his injured paw. She offers him freshly picked berries, honey from her provisions, and water from the creek. Slowly, she moves in closer and closer. until one day she gets close enough to pull out the splinter. And he lets out a terrible roar. But instead of running away, she looks directly into the moon bear's eyes. She felt she could see entire mountain ranges, valleys, rivers, and villages reflected in the bear's old, old eyes. A deep peace settled over her. So the trip back down the mountain is fast and easy. The dangerous river is now just a gently flowing stream. And there are no dark birds flying overhead. Just ordinary ones chirping happily in the treetops. So eager is she to see her husband that she decides to go home before taking the hare to the healer. To her surprise, there's a fire burning in the cook pit outside the hut. Then her husband steps forward and greets her with a smile. When he asks where she's been, she shows him the white hare. Taking it, he regards it for a moment and then tosses it into the fire. "Oh, no," she cries. "What have you done?" As the hare sparks and hisses and goes up in smoke, he reaches out and gently takes her hand. So, that's the story. What does this story reveal about silent illumination? So that's what I'm going to talk about now. The story starts out by saying, once there was a woman who lived in the foothills of a beautiful mountain. That she lives in the foothills tells us she's a spiritual seeker. She's a meditator. And in her meditation, she has tapped into some deep anger. So this is a story about a meditator on a spiritual journey. One that takes her through, not around, over or under, but through her deepest and strongest emotions. Because silent illumination, although it's a lovely expression, it's not about sitting in some contrived bliss, learning nothing about suffering, the cause of suffering, and the means to alleviate suffering for ourselves and others. Silent illumination is not about that. So the low-hanging branches and dense underbrush represent the veils that we penetrate in meditation. Traditional Buddhism talks a lot about the veils, the bases of which are the three poisons, pursuing, avoiding, and the general lack of understanding, the three poisons. So in the beginning, she uses her karma to cut through the thicket. Now, this is not Manjushri's sword, you guys. She doesn't want to deal with her attachments and aversions. She sees them as obstacles to the path. So this is the silent aspect of silent illumination. But it's a shut-down silence. There's no illumination. And when we seek calmness, this is what we do. We try to cut off our thoughts instead of just seeing them without getting caught up in them. But the further she goes, the more overgrown the trail becomes, at times disappearing altogether. Oh, when the trail disappears, when our mind wanders off, we bring ourselves back over and over, back to the silence while staying open. So that's her effort. That's what she's trying to do. But with great difficulty. She's having great difficulty, which is what the shallow river is all about. Because this is not a river that flows. It's choppy and chaotic. In his book, Wake Up to Your Life, the teacher and author Ken McLeod writes, "As water cascades down a rock face, it splashes from rock to rock. At this stage of meditation, the subjective experience is chaos. Thoughts bounce all over the place. There is no sense of flow or continuity of attention." So she keeps getting pulled into mental activity. And her ability to sustain a consistent flow of attention just isn't there yet. But she is starting to see it. Before she wasn't even open to it. Now she's starting to see it. And because she's starting to see it, the silence penetrates even deeper. When night comes, there is a sliver of a moon. The moon represents wisdom in Buddhism. And in my experience, the first inkling of a pent-up emotion is always kind of vague. So there's just enough moon to cast shadows. And according to Dr. Estes, Clarissa Estes, the birds represent the dead but unsettled ghosts of the past. So now she's seeing through the anger. She's seeing below the anger. And there's something unsettled there, which is the source of it. Loneliness, perhaps. Existential loneliness from a sense of separation, maybe. Or maybe it's something more urgent, like childhood traumas or neglect or abuse. Whatever it is, we know it's big enough to carry her off. She's no longer on her cushion. She doesn't know where she is. When this happens, there's neither silence nor illumination because she's in her head. She's trying to figure it out. But eventually, she returns. But now she's rattled and confused from trying to figure out the emotion. And she's lost the trail. But she didn't jump up off her cushion and run out of the zendo. What does she do? She seeks shelter in a cave. But in mythological stories, what always happens in a cave? How many of you know the story of Milarepa in the Cave of Demons? How about the story of Luke Skywalker's failure in the cave? How many of you know about that one? That scene is one of the most memorable of the trilogy, a trilogy filled with memorable images. But in this story, there's no failure in the cave. She doesn't fail in the cave. She stays with the sensations of her strong emotions. She perseveres. How do we know that? Because when she comes out of the cave the next morning, she easily finds the trail. Illumination. We also know it because of the absence of the kama, the blade. She's no longer cutting off her emotions. She's opened up to them. And they begin to yield. They begin to yield. She's starting to understand that the difficulties that we face in meditation are not separate from our life. They are our life. And they bring great energy and insight. So finally she reaches the summit and comes face to face with the moon bear. But now, after her long trek up the mountain, she's prepared to face her deepest trauma. What is that deep trauma that she's going to face? We're not told that. We don't have to examine and analyze it. In utter clarity, things appear. And there is nothing unclear about this bear towering over her, roaring angrily, with a big splinter in his paw. Nothing unclear about that. And she doesn't ask him where he came from or how he got to the summit. She doesn't ask him how he got the splinter in his paw or trying to figure out what kind of splinter it was. She doesn't do that. As long as the splinter is there, making him foul and mean, there's no way she's going to get close enough to pluck a white hair from the crescent moon on his chest. So what she does is watch. For days, she just watches. And after days of watching and attending to the moon bear, she's able to get close enough to pull out the splinter. And he let out a mighty roar and lowered his fierce head to look directly in her eyes. But she is unwavering in her attention, unwavering in her perseverance. Now, this is a frightening moment, but she doesn't run away. She's unwavering. And looking into his old, old eyes, she felt she could see entire mountain ranges, rivers, valleys, and villages. And a deep peace settles over her. So then she moved even closer to rub the herbal mix onto the wound. Now, in the beginning of the story, she goes into the village to seek a healer. But now she is the healer. Transformation. Transformation. It's guaranteed in this practice. So, in silence, words are forgotten. In utter clarity, things appear. When we move that close to our strong emotions, there's no separation between our awareness and the emotion. We move directly into it. And that merging is the manifestation of our kind awareness. It's the healing energy of presence. And it's always available to us. And then utter clarity. In utter clarity, the emotion arises, moves through our body, and then dissolves. So in the end, the white hair that represents a gift from Kuan Yin sparks and hisses and then goes up in smoke. And when that happens, when our emotions go up in smoke, when they dissolve, what more is there to clarify? It is completely clarified. It clarified itself. So that's what I have to offer about that story. Buddha taught that every Dharma has within it some insight about reality. Every Dharma means everything that arises in our mind. Our guiding teacher, Tim Burkett, said, when you're sitting in meditation and feeling your strong emotions, it may not feel like you're experiencing them with grace. But if you don't jump up and run out of the zendo, then you are experiencing your strong emotions with grace. So, I'm going to end with that. Anybody have any comments or questions? Yeah.
What strong emotion have you experienced?
Oh my God, we don't want to go there. Not here, not now. We all have our strong emotions. In private, I would talk. Okay? Yes?
What was the role of the angry warrior husband in the story?
That represented her anger that she tapped into.
So the husband was part of her in the story?
Yes. Remember I said in the beginning there are no characters in this story. They're all aspects of our psyche.
So the masculine side of...
No. I think we can get just as angry as our counterparts. Anybody else? Well, thank you for being here.